Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. It is a great honor to have Seymour Epstein on the show. Epstein is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. A noted authority on personality, he has received continuous research support from the National Institute of Mental Health for over 40 years and has received their coveted Merit Award. He has published extensively, including the books You're Smarter Than You Think, Constructive Thinking, The Key to Emotional Intelligence, and most recently, Cognitive Experiential Theory and Integrative Theory of Personality. Thanks, Seymour, for talking to me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You're one of my intellectual heroes, I guess we could say, and a lot of work I did in my dissertation was heavily influenced by your theory. I thought we could start kind of the roots of this theory that you came up with, or even your interest in psychology in the first place. When did your interest in psychology begin?
When I was a student at Brooklyn College, for the first 3 years, I didn't know what I should be, and I took some counseling on it, and I decided I definitely don't want psychology. At least that's what he led me to believe. But as I thought about it later, I decided that's where my heart is, and that's what I'm going to do. I also found out that there was a program in the VA for training psychologists and paying them pretty well at the same time. So that was further thing that influenced me.
Seymour,
I've always been interested in what makes people work the way they do.
What year are we talking here? When did you start your PhD training in psychology?
Let me check.
It was a little while ago, right?
Yeah. I got into Brooklyn College in Brooklyn, New York, in 1948.
Wow.
Yeah, that's when I started there. And then you want to find out?
No, that's fine. That's good. That's good. So we're talking the 40s. So when you were getting into psychology, what was hot then? We're talking behavioralism was the thing of the day, right?
Yes.
And so your first encounter with psychology were, you know, Freud and behavioralism, and this is pre-third wave, this is pre-Maslow, right? So,
well, Maslow was one of my instructors.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't like him.
Why is that? Tell me why.
He was too subjective. But he would give these very quick examinations in a form that he could rate them very easily. True and false, multiple choice,
right,
that kind of thing. And I could never figure out how he determined what was right and what was wrong. And I'd put down things that I thought was right, and I studied very hard because I wasn't doing so well in that class.
That's amazing. So Seymour Epstein didn't do that well in Abraham Maslow's class. That's an amazing story. So what was your final grade?
I got a B.
A B. And that was, what course was that? Was that like personality?
Yeah, it was like personality.
Wow. So you did encounter these sorts of ideas. And then, so tell me about when you started to construct this first dual process theory. And yeah, tell me about the evolution of that theory.
Well, it started when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin. And my first paper was exploratory. It was what makes people think the way they do. That was a topic that interested me always. And two principles occurred to me. One is that we, like other animals, are animals. Nobody's disputing that. And the second fundamental assumption is that although we operate with an animal mind in part, we obviously have another mind that makes us human. And I decided to call that the rational mind. And the other one I call the experiential mind, because it adapts by learning from experience. And those two assumptions are basic to the whole rest of the theory.
Right. So this idea of the unconscious that you proposed was quite different from Freud's notion of the unconscious, right?
Yeah, I think Freud is nuts. I didn't think so at first, but after I started to develop my theory, where did the unconscious come from? If we're an animal like other animals don't have a conscious mind. They work completely with their unconscious mind by learning from experience. How else can they adapt? I thought that was a very important point to emphasize and to realize what the limitation was in Freud. And that's that he has two minds, a conscious mind and an unconscious mind. And his unconscious mind, he got from studying mainly dreams and himself and others. He never talks about animal behavior. Why is that?
Right.
It's because animals, if they have only those two systems, conscious and unconscious, then they'd be incapable of adapting, because the only effective system they would have at the unconscious level is not adaptive. It's not adaptive. If you behave as the unconscious mind does by reacting according to your automatic processing, you would not be able to adapt effectively, because the Freudian unconscious mind does not exist in animals. They have an unconscious, they don't have an experiential mind. So I needed to find a mind other than the rational mind that accounted for people's unconscious behavior. And the obvious thing to me, my theory is self-evident. It's very simple. Where would an unconscious mind come from? The same mind that animals have. So we react automatically, we learn automatically from experience. And that's highly adaptive. It does have its limitations, but so does the rational mind. So neither mind is superior to the other. They're both necessary. And in fact, we operate on a day-by-day basis with our experiential mind, with its automatic. So that started the theory going.
Right, but how did you have that insight?
I it just seemed self-evident to me.
But no one else had it?
That amazes me. It amazes me that in 100 years following Freud, nobody realized that our unconscious thinking is the experiential system, and that we share with animals. So I have an assumption of why we have an experiential mind, and Freud does not. He doesn't have an explanation of why we have an unconscious mind.
How was your theory received at first?
How was your
theory first received?
People showed mild interest. They didn't make a path to my door. They still don't. Some do. I get some very favorable emails. But the field as a whole has not adopted my theory. It will. It's the only way the field can go. When you look at what the alternatives are, there are no alternatives other than Freud with his unconscious, which is unacceptable because it wouldn't work in animals with this unconscious mind.
Right.
So that's the way I got started. I also got started by being influenced by people like Rogers. I have a very open mind, and I'm impressed with how few people have a very open mind, and that's why they did not recognize the importance. Recognize that we are animals and have a reasoning mind, and that differentiates us from other animals. So that was fine. That was a good beginning. And I was influenced by people like Rogers and his self-concept. Now, I knew that Allport and one other guy had argued against the self-concept, except as a descriptor. They said it doesn't do anything. It just describes how people behave. Well, I don't think that's true. And as I third it, so they said Rogers' view is interesting but unacceptable as science. It's not science. It's only a descriptive variable. Whereas I like the aspect of the self-concept that said the experience, well, that said people operate automatically in a way that is out of their awareness. So that's beginning for the unconscious mind. So that's the way I began. I said if we change some of Roger's thinking a little bit, we'll have a new theory. And what's unacceptable is theory was considered unverifiable by Roger and by Allport. Well, I thought that was too much of a limitation. I wanted to keep the action-oriented unconscious one that was adaptive. It just didn't go far enough to say the self-concept is an automatic mind, but it's only descriptive. So people, they have no objection against having an unconscious mind as part of the self-concept, so long as the unscientific aspect of the self-concept are not included. Now, how can we make Rogers' theory, etc. How do we have to modify it? The way it's really simple. We just say that people react automatically with their animal mind, and that accounts for the experiential system. It's an adaptive system. Works fine in animals, doesn't. And it sometimes works fine, and sometimes doesn't. That's the way I began. And then I did not intend to build an integrative theory. That occurred following my basic assumption as a new thought to me that people are animals and therefore they have an experiential mind and a rational mind. And the rest of it got brought into focus as I started to write and wondered what else does this indicate. So the rest of the theory was built upon building on my basic assumption and my attraction Sir Roger's self concept, just even a little modification was that there's an experiential system that operates automatically outside of awareness. It's the animal mind. And there's a hell of a lot of research on the animal mind. And what surprises me is that the people who wrote in that way, in the way of accepting animal learning, but only with regard to responses. Whereas a little innovation I made is what is learned through conditioning is not only responsive behavior, not only overt behavior, but also thoughts that are unconscious and adaptive and are the experiential mind. So the theory gradually developed from there. It amazed me that many theorists never came up with the idea that their concepts apply to learning cognition, beliefs, as well as behavior. And once you make that assumption, it throws everything wide open.
Right. Did you ever meet Alport or Rogers?
I'm thinking, yes, I met Alport. I was a visiting professor at Harvard, and I met him. And I thought he's going to be an interesting guy to talk to. But he froze in my presence when I spoke to him about my theory. I was surprised.
Oh, wow. I'm surprised, too.
Yeah.
What about Rogers?
I never met Rogers.
Okay.
But I did correspond with him. And I like his way of thinking with some limits. And I think I introduced the solution to what I consider the major limits in his theory.
Indeed. I mean, you did propose a holistic personality theory.
Yeah.
So that's something that
the reason that I finally decided it was an integrative theory is not on my own. It's the responses I got to my theory when I gave talks on it. Somebody who identified himself as a psychoanalyst would say, I like your theory, has a lot in common with psychoanalysis. In fact, I was completely comfortable for it because it doesn't change much of my thinking from psychoanalysis. And that's nonsense, because it does. It is different from psychoanalysis. But not only did a psychoanalyst in the audience say he liked my theory, but learning theorists, behaviorists, said they found my theory quite acceptable. It fit with learning theory fine. There are a few advances, but most of it was fine. Of course, it was similar to learning theory. So enough people from different disciplines told me that my theory was acceptable to them because it was like their theory. Then I feel, holy cow, that indicates that my theory must be pretty integrated. Now these people from various different disciplines like my theory.
Right.
So that's the way it developed.
And when did your idea for the constructive thinking concept develop?
Oh, boy.
It's okay. You don't have to come up with the exact date. It's okay. Don't worry about it. So your idea for your constructing thinking inventory, you found that it was it's part of the experiential system? Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, everything is part of both systems.
Okay.
What's different is the degree to which they influence behavior. So
what does it mean to be a good constructive thinker?
It means to have a developing experiential system that is adaptive It's the way people automatically react. They got that way through automatic conditioning. And you can learn to influence your experiential thinking. And I write about that too. So the automatic thinking is very, very fundamental in the experiential system.
Right. And you found that no correlation between IQ and constructive thinking?
I was surprised.
Yeah.
According to my theory, there should be a slightly negative and positive relationship between the two. There should be a slightly positive relationship between the two.
Okay.
But it's very close to a zero correlation. So they are a different concept. And constructive thinking has a global scale, which is similar to overall IQ, but in the experiential. And it has not only the that aspect to it, the experiential system is adaptive in its own unique ways, which are the ways that we, most of us, react most of the time. It comes across in the street. We don't reason out whether it's safe to cross. We do it automatically. And that's the way most of our behavior is done.
Right. So your recent research on the experiential system has shown that it has three major components: intuition, emotionality, and imagination.
Yeah.
If imagination is part of it, that's not something we share with other animals, is it?
No, I think it is.
Okay.
It is. Animals remember things by forming images of them, keeping them in their head. So it does make a difference.
Okay. And for your experiential system, emotionality is a core component of it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that differs from some other theory. As you know, there are a lot of dual process theories.
Sure.
That exists now.
After I introduced myself.
Exactly.
They jumped up like mushrooms. Some of them even claiming that it was their original theory. And they said they liked Epstein's theory, because it shares a lot with their theory. Their theory is unique because if it's a theory by a social psychologist, it is addressed to social psychological issues, and Epstein's theory doesn't have that emphasis. True, but that doesn't mean that their theory preceded mine. Their theory obviously followed mine, and they have to misinterpret some of my stuff in order to maintain that position.
Right. I mean, Kahneman Tversky's dual process theory, you know, you predate that theory, and that's a very problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he corresponded with me. He gives me some credit in his first article.
Good.
But not after that.
Okay. So your theory has some deep implications, which you've discussed, implications for religion, implications for clinical practice. Do you want to discuss some of those implications?
Religion is obvious.
Right. What about
our religious beliefs are unrealistic. Like Jesus coming from a virgin. I don't believe that one bit. Or the people who believe in Noah's Ark, that Noah was able to get two creatures throughout the whole world that represented every creature there is unthinkable. You couldn't even do that with the number of bugs there are. There's so many different species. And to take his boat and get to places that are inland seems hard to believe, but it's impossible, of course. and to go to the North Pole and pick up polar bears, and then go to the South Pole and pick up penguins. That doesn't make much sense that he would do that in the time he had with the equipment he had. So why do some people take this literally? Not everybody, of course. When I test students for my usual experimental subjects, so I was talking about
religion. But it's okay. Religion. We can also talk about clinical implications if you want.
No, religion is fine. Okay. Because it falls neatly into the operation of the experiential system.
Right. For sure.
And so categorical thinking, wishful thinking, and so on. And I've written a paper on that. But it's being considered for publication now. If you like, I'll send you a copy.
Oh, please send me a copy, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So if you have anything you want to explain in religion, and anything involving irrational behavior, I'll show you how the experiential system can account for it.
That would be great. I mean, it's great that you can explain that. It has such great predictive validity. What about politics? Do you think there's differences in thinking styles amongst different parties?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard, watching the debates, one woman say, Bernie or Hillary.
Yeah.
And she said she loves Bernie with her heart, and she loves Hillary with her mind.
Oh, there you go.
Experiential rational. And I think that everybody has a mixture of both. There's no pure experiential rational. It's a matter of how dominant each is in a particular situation. And that will vary with the person and the situation.
That's great.
So, for politicians, it's very important. The experiential system is very important.
Right.
The experiential system influences people's behavior and thinking, including conscious thinking. It biases conscious thinking.
Right.
So that a lot of people's rational explanations are rationalizations, not careful reason thinking.
And then what do you see for implications for clinical psychology, the future of clinical psychology?
Well, for one, I think people would have to change how they think in terms of the clients, of course. And that would vary with who they are and what the situation is.
So context matters a lot. And do you see your theory integrated well with cognitive behavioral therapy approaches?
I could compare my theory to that.
Okay.
Yes. That's the theory that comes closest to it. It doesn't have an experiential system.
Right.
And they dodge that question. They say they're not going to get into that. It's too esoteric. Because they think of the unconscious mind, they should get into it with the experiential system.
Did you say you can't compare it?
I can compare it.
You can,
it. I do compare it.
Yeah.
And its main limitation is it does not have an experiential system. And therefore, it's handling mainly things that people can consciously describe. The others, they say, they're not interested in. It's too complicated to deal with the unconscious mind.
Right.
And so they just don't deal with that.
Right. But one could use your list of constructive thinking questions as a good model for psychotherapy, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think constructive thinking should be taught in almost all cases, not in all, but almost all, because no matter what the source of the disorder is a person can almost always benefit from improving their constructive thinking.
And you see constructive thinking as, how does that relate to emotional intelligence?
It relates very well to emotional intelligence, except it's the experiential system is not all emotions.
Right.
With other very fundamental attributes.
I remember in one of your books that I really liked on constructive thinking, you argue it's a key to emotional intelligence, and you compare it to like the Solvay model of emotion, the Meyer and Solvay model. And
yeah.
I thought that was really neat. So you're 91 years old, and you're a legend in the field of psychology. Is there any further frontiers you still want to, you know, achieve, or anything that you you're working on right now that you want to share with the audience?
Well, not really. The contribution of my book on largely experiential thinking, I'm pretty stuck in that. And
yeah,
my thinking hasn't changed in reference to that, and so I don't have any further work planned. I may write a few articles in line with that.
Great.
Applying that to different situations.
Great. Well, thank you for the contribution you've made to the field and for being so generous with your time today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.